This is the NCARB podcast, where you get an inside look at licensure, regulation, and the initiatives shaping the future of architectural practice. I'm your host, Andy McIntyre, Vice President of Marketing and Communications at NCARB. And this season, we're diving into Pathways to Practice, NCARB's multi-year effort to rethink how architects become licensed.
Architecture is the hardware to the software of life, right? It is fundamentally about that interaction, and it makes life easier if we have a built environment that works.
Across 8 episodes, we'll explore how licensure got to where it is today and where it needs to go next. We talk with architects, educators, regulators, and NCARB leaders about education, experience, and the exam, and why each of those pillars is evolving.
And that portion of school where you go from conceptual to real is also really challenging. It's not something you're really gently moved into. It's kind of like you're doing something that's flowy and crazy, and all of a sudden, wait, you actually have to make this work.
You'll hear how the NCARB competency standard was developed, how research is shaping future licensure models, and what a more flexible, competency-based approach could mean for candidates from a wide range of backgrounds.
So we've seen that in our data as the number of reciprocal licenses starts to decrease a little bit, but that number of individuals who are licensed holds steady.
We also tackle the big questions. Why does licensure look the way it does today? Where do candidates face the biggest barriers? And how can we expand access without lowering standards?
Not everybody fits into the same mold. And so having different pathways to licensure, I think, is really important.
Whether you're a licensure candidate, an educator, a firm leader, or a regulator, this season offers clarity, context, and transparency into one of the most important conversations facing the profession.
Does this requirement to complete all divisions of the exam place an unfair burden on any one group or other?
This is Pathways to Practice, only on the NCARB podcast. Please follow the link in the show notes, subscribe now, and join us as we explore the future of architectural licensure.
My name is Mark R. LePage, and you are listening to Entree Architect Podcast, where each week I speak with inspiring, passionate people who share their knowledge and expertise, all to help you build a better business as a small firm entrepreneur architect. My guest today is architect Ryan Tavis, founder of a Nashville-based practice rooted in the principles of organic architecture. Early in his career, Ryan had the rare opportunity to work with not one, but two Taliesin apprentices, gaining a direct connection to the legacy of Frank Lloyd Wright. That experience shaped not only how he designs, but how he thinks about life, purpose, and the role architects play in the world. Today, we explore what it means to carry that legacy forward and how those lessons can still influence small firm architects today. Ryan Tavis, welcome to Entree Architect Podcast.
Thanks, Mark. I appreciate it. Very excited to be on here. Love what you do for the profession. Love your show. And so I appreciate you. Thanks.
Yeah, you're very welcome. Thanks for being here. We connected online. You heard about the Taliesin experience and you reached out. And for anybody who was at the Nashville TCAM, our conference in Nashville, Ryan was a huge asset to us by introducing us to one of the house tours. And so that was, if you were there and you went on the house tour, you could thank Ryan for that. He made that connection for us. And so when Ryan heard that we were heading to Taliesin this summer, he reached out and said, "Hey, I have some stories to tell." So I wanted to have you on the show here, Ryan.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Let's start with your origin story. When did you discover your passion for architecture, and who or what inspired you to get started?
Yeah. And I think this will probably lead into the topic is I grew up in a small town in Southern Indiana and was always kind of good at just art, just drawing, anything like that. So being in a small town, I think, you know, small town culture, nobody knows how to lead you or what to do with that. And so everybody just said, "Yeah, you should be an architect." Yeah, I think Brady Bunch or whatever they saw on TV, they think that drawing is architecture and that's what you should do. So I didn't know any better either. So the whole time growing up, I just kind of was going to be an architect. That's just what I thought I'd do.
Do you remember how old you were when you first decided that was the path?
Yeah, I think, I mean, it had to be middle school age. I know it was middle school age. I don't know, fifth grade, sixth grade. It was sometime around then, because my buddy was going to be an engineer and I was going to be an architect.
And there you go. And take on the world.
We're going to be a team.
Yeah.
So yeah, it was kind of that early on. I think, you know, second or third grade is when I started developing a talent for drawing.
Yeah.
And so it was sometime between second, third grade and beginning of middle school. And that's just what, like I said, it's probably TV.
Yeah, yeah.
Brady Bunch, who knows? But everybody's just like, yeah, you should be an architect. So,
is there any creativity in your family?
Not really. I think my grandparents, musically, my grandpa was a very good musician. But as far as artistic, drawing and stuff like that, no, not really. It's kind of unique, I guess. I mean, most of my family and parents, it's kind of business, economics, banking, stuff like that. Finance is my background of my family.
Yeah. So saw the talent, decided you're going to be an architect. Where'd you take it?
Yeah. So graduated and decided to apply to a few different schools, but decided that Ball State was in state in Indiana and looked just as good as everything else. So went up to Ball State and started my architecture journey there. And honestly, you get in there and then you realize that it had nothing to do with drawing, really. I mean, we were still at that point, that was 95, 96. So the computer really wasn't, we were drawing by hand our plans, but that's not what we were getting graded on. We were getting graded on creativity and ideas and problem solving, which is
right. Not
what I thought it was. So, and I think it's a lot of people are like that, because you get a lot of students that drop out once they realize.
That's what first year architecture program is all about, is to weed out the people who want to become architects and the ones who thought they wanted to become architects.
Yeah. So I'm like, all right, well, this isn't what I thought it was, but I guess I'm kind of a stubborn guy. It's like, this doesn't mean I don't want to do that. I just need to learn how to do it. And so it's interesting, you know, you look and see other students there, like, how do they come up with that? How do they think about that? And you wonder, is it a learned behavior? Or is it something they were just born with? Can I do that eventually? You know, do I need to teach myself how to do that? And so I think that kind of fascinated me more than anything else is, you know, how do you become creative? Or can you teach yourself to think differently?
Yeah.
And so, and I think that's kind of where the whole interest in Frank Lloyd Wright came, is we got, I don't know if it was first year studio or second year. But early on, they gave us a project. We had to design a research center. And then they gave six or so different, you know, like a desert or the ocean or the mountains or the Arctic. And so you had these different locations and that's what you were assigned. And we had to design a research center for that. I got assigned the swamp. And so, you know, what do you do with that? It's a research center that's over water. What's the most famous building that's over water? Frank Lloyd Wright's Falling Water. So there was a student that had a poster of Taliesin behind their desk down the studio. So, you know, he set out to design. So I go over and stand in front of his desk, look at the picture of Falling Water, you know, the traditional one with the waterfall in front, and go back to the seat and sit down and decide, well, I'm going to draw that building. And it's not like any building that I'm used to in Southern Indiana where you can look at it, understand what's going on the inside from the outside and translate that into a plan. I went back to my desk to try and draw it. And I'm like, well, I have no idea what this is. So I go back and stand in front of his desk again, go back to try and draw again. No. So that got me super fascinated, that the complexity that you just don't realize when you're sitting there staring at some of these things, that you can't just go back and draw it. Like, there's so many layers to it that I don't understand. And so that got me going to the library, looking up falling water floor plans, sections, elevations, and just got completely fascinated by that one building to begin with, which kind of just led into other buildings of his and how he thinks, how he designs, his problem solving, reaction to the environment, and, you know, how he uses that in a whole different way than other people, other architects at that time. So that became my fascination with Wright at that point. And like I said, it was the late 90s. Like, they weren't teaching Frank Lloyd Wright. He'd been dead for a while. So they're not teachers, and academics is not, it's a chapter in our history book.
Right.
They're not really pushing, you need to learn Frank Lloyd Wright or study this or going in depth in it. So that's just something I kind of had to do on my own.
So from that inspiration, first or second year of architecture school, it hooked you? Were you a Frank Lloyd Wright fan from that point forward?
I was, but not necessarily copying Frank Lloyd Wright, because you start seeing Falling Water, you start seeing his later work and how it started evolving from then. And then you go back to the early 1900s and the Prairie School and all the stuff. And he's a fascinating character and a fascinating career on how he reinvented himself a few times and how his design progressed and evolved. And so you get to thinking that if he died in 1959 and it's 1999, 40 years later, how would have it evolved in that 40 years? You know, if the front end 40 years evolved that much, what would it look like now? And so
imagine what he would have been designing all those 40 years later.
Yeah. Yeah. And the best way to do that is to, you know, he had a school. He taught students. He taught apprentices. Let's go find some of those and see what they're doing now. And so that was the next step, right? Is from Frank Lloyd Wright to some of the apprentices that went on, not that they all didn't go on to follow in his footsteps, but there are some of them that did amazing work afterwards. And, you know, you look at all those examples and you kind of get a little bit of a direction on how things would have been had he still been alive and practicing. And so that was the next step, is kind of after being fascinated with him, see the people that he taught and who's out there working now.
Yeah. Did you start doing that research in school and look what came after Frank Lloyd Wright?
I did. Yeah, I did. And I mean, there were some books. There was a book of Taliesin apprentices that I've got here somewhere that it was a great start. And one of the guys that I worked for, Robert Green, was listed in there. But mostly it was a networking thing where you just start calling and talking to people and getting to know this person and that person, and realizing that not everybody was in that book and there are other people out there doing things. And during college, you know, at Ball State, we were required to do an internship that would last one summer and then a semester. And so I got really excited and decided to send my resume out to a few people. So there wasn't much email going on, so you still had to type up a resume and mail it out. So Aaron Green was a guy, the architect that worked for Frank Lloyd Wright out in San Francisco, actually head of his, I think they called it a California Taliesin. Or Frank Lloyd Wright tried to establish an office in California, and Aaron Green was the architect that represented that. So he was out there. Sent a letter to Edgar Taffel, who was one of the early on apprentices that worked on Falling Water, and he was practicing in New York. And then I sent one to Robert Green, who was down in Atlanta. Like I said, this was kind of the beginning of email and the internet. Robert Green, if you typed in Frank Lloyd Wright, Robert Green would come up. Like, whoever did his website must have knew what they were doing, because search engine optimization wasn't a thing at the time, but
right. They
had it nailed. So as far as I knew, like, Robert Green was so well known as the, you know, but it was all the internet. So sent those three resumes out, didn't hear back from anybody. Eventually I got a letter back from Edgar Taffel. I was very excited about that. Opened it up, and it was my original resume and cover letter that he had sent back to me with a red pen, and just marked it up, like edited it. Like, I use the pronoun I too much, so he circled every little time that I use the pronoun I.
And oh my goodness.
Yeah, so that was disappointing.
A little resume crit.
Yeah, it was a critique, yeah. Like, so, yeah, that's you're all excited to get the letter in the mail, and you open it up, and it's that.
Oh my goodness.
He wrote a little hand thing on the back and said, hey, I don't have any projects going on, I'm not hiring, but maybe somebody on Staten Island is hiring or something. And I'm like, oh, that's great. Never got anything back from Aaron Green. And then by that time, hadn't heard anything and needed to get my plans locked in. There was a really good architect down in Evansville, Indiana, that I had worked for, like, over breaks and over summers, named Bill Geiser. super creative guy. And so had the very fortunate to find him. And so I just called him up and said, hey, I'll come do my internship with you, apprenticeship with you. But then honestly, it was a couple days later, couldn't have been a week later. I got the letter back in the mail from Robert Green in Atlanta. And he's like, hey, I lost your letter on my desk, but I got a lot of projects and I need you to come down. But by that time, I had already committed to Bill Geiser in Evansville and can't go back on my word. So I was
good man.
I was crushed.
Yeah.
I was crushed of what I wanted to do and, you know, the path I wanted to go. And I just didn't feel like I could do that. And so had to tell him no and just went on to, you know, work for Bill for that apprenticeship and then, you know, all through college, really. But, you know, the good thing about that is it came back. I got my opportunity again later on.
So how did that work?
Yeah. So I kept studying and looking. I subscribed to something I think was called the Journal of the Taliesin Fellows, where they would send out this journal quarterly or month. I can't think, probably quarterly, featuring a different fellow of Taliesin, a different apprentice in their work. And beginning of my senior year, the journal that showed up in the mail covered this guy named Don Erickson, who was up in Chicago. And never heard of him, you know, and all the research and everything I did, never heard of him, but his work was absolutely fantastic. Like, it was super creative, didn't copyright at all, but you could definitely tell by looking at it that it was heavily influenced by Wright. So it was just like, it was really, really hit everything, every mark that I was looking for. Like, what would Frank Lloyd Wright be doing 40 years later? And this is it. So he was up in Chicago. I was, you know, kind of in Northern Indiana, Northeastern Indiana, and girlfriend that I was dating, who's my wife now, her parents live up in Milwaukee. So we were going to go up there for Thanksgiving. So I called up Don and just said, hey, I'm going to be traveling through there. Is it all right? I'd love to meet you. Is it all right if I just stop by and say hello? And he said, yeah, come on by. So over Thanksgiving, we went up and visited with him and spoke with him. It was in his house, which he designed for himself, which was just amazing. Really, really cool place. You know, to be in something that he designed and came up with for himself was just super impressive for me. And so, yeah, we kind of hit it off. And I think he was energized by me, you know, taking such a interest in his work that I mentioned that I'd be graduating and kind of just went ahead and asked, hey, can I come work for you for the summer? I'll come work for you for the summer when it's fall. My wife's an optometrist, so she had a couple more years of school left before she graduated. So, you know, when she went back to work, I was just planning on going back and working for Bill down in Evansville. So he said, yeah, come on up. So we spent the summer working for Don up in Chicago, which was really cool. He had a lady that came in, a draftsman that would come in. He did not use the computer. He was actually, I think it was a bone cancer or some sort of cancer, and he was on treatments for a long time. He told me, he's like, every time I go into the doctor, they tell me I have 6 months to live, you know, and they've been telling me that for years. But, you know, because of all the treatments and everything, he was just shaking. He could barely, you know, when he's drawing a sketch for me, it's just all over the place. And so he had a draftsman come in a couple days a week that would do computer drafting for him. And Don's wife was an interior designer, and so they had an office together. She would do drawings for both of them. So I came in and just kind of supplemented that and would help him do drawings on some of the current projects that Don had, which was it was very educational because he couldn't draw. So what he would do was just sit behind me for 8 hours a day watching me draw.
Oh my goodness.
And talking in my ear. And so it was very educational.
A little bit wider. Let's make it a little bit taller.
Super stressful. Why did you draw that over? Why did you put that line over there? Why did you know? And so, but with that, he was very, very knowledgeable of, I mean, just even what size bolt you need to put in here. And so he would have me drawing super detailed sections.
Yeah. As frustrating as that was, it probably was an incredible education.
Yeah. I mean, I learned so much, you know. It's like learn by doing kind of mentality of Taliesin. And that was kind of that, because he's just sitting there constantly telling me, not don't do this, you know, not just, hey, draw this or hey, do that, but why? Like, you need to put this here and do it at this location. And this is why, because this is how they're going to build it. And so, you know, it's kind of learned by doing, but him explaining it. And so, yeah, like I said, super stressful, but really, really educational. Denise was the draftsman. And she said, you know, before he was kind of going through all this medical treatment, so he would come in late, work for a little while, go eat lunch, take a long nap, come in for a couple hours after this nap, then the day would be done. But she's like, you know, when you showed up, he was just totally energizing. And so he was there before I was every day. We worked all through the day, even longer. You know, he got really energized by me being there, even to the point where he would just come up with an idea of a house without a client, and we would work on that. I mean, he was just getting ideas out of his head. And so.
Right, right. He was practicing through you.
Yeah. So that was really cool.
You gave him the ability to practice again.
Yeah, it was pretty fascinating. To the point where after my 3 months of summer were up and I was supposed to go home, I came in one day and he let Denise go and said, we got Ryan here. We don't need you too. And I was like, oh man. So at that point I couldn't leave. So he kind of forced me to stay by doing that move. And so that led me to kind of stay there and work with him for, you know, a few years after that, which was again, great, amazing experience. We went through a lot of different projects.
And when did you leave, Don?
Kind of like what I had to do. My wife, in her last year of optometry school, they had to do rotations, and they get to pick where they want to do rotations. So the first one she picked was in Golden, Colorado, right outside Denver. Second one was Atlanta, and then back to Indianapolis, and then back into Indiana University in Bloomington. So I told Don, I was like, hey, I'm going to travel with her for those first two rotations to Colorado and then to Atlanta. So immediately got on the phone with Robert Green and was like, I'm going to be in Atlanta for 3 months. I missed my opportunity first. I want another shot. And he's like, I don't know that I have the work. And so he said no many times. And I just kept every couple of weeks. I didn't want to bug him, but every couple of weeks I would, hey, remember, I'm going to be in Atlanta. Like, you don't even have to pay me. Like, I will just come in and organize your files. I'll do whatever. You know, I just, so yeah, I went out to, Don was cool with that. The projects, we didn't have as many projects going on. I think stuff was starting to slow down a little bit. So
did Don know Robert?
He did not. Don was in Taliesin from 1948 to 1952. And then Robert Green was in 1958. He left when Mr. Wright died in 1959. So they did not know each other. You know, I showed, like I said, I had that book of Taliesin and fellows. So I showed Don some of his work. But other than that, no, they didn't know each other at all.
So what did you do with Robert?
Yeah. So went out to Colorado, worked out there in just a kind of office. They were doing spec homes. And then finally, I think I wore him down where he's like, I've got a new project coming. I could use you. It's like, I don't know if I can use you for the whole 3 months, but yeah, come and work. So got to go back to Atlanta and I worked for Mr. Green. He lived in kind of an apartment, like a 3-level apartment. And the basement of that was his office. So with Don Erickson, his office was in his house as well. It was above his garage. He let me actually live in his guest house. So it was a heck of a setup. But, you know, Mr. Green had an office in his basement. And no computer, all by hand. So we just drafted by hand, which is the first and only time I've ever had to do that. But, you know, so interesting that I would go in and start drawing in the morning. And then he'd be like, yeah, it's lunchtime. And I'm like, that flew. Like, you know.
Yeah, you get into a zone.
Yeah, you do. And you get eat lunch, you come back, start working. He's like, yeah, time to go. And I mean, it's just the days flew. He had a house that he was designing in North Carolina that was very, very writing and very derivative of Bright's kind of Usonian style that we were working on. And so just drew that by hand, you know, the whole summer. And once that was over, I think he had a few things he needed me to do. But other than that, I mean, it was pretty much just that one project and a few miscellaneous things on another one. So, you know, Don Erickson, I think Don Erickson actually taught some college course, you know, architecture at some universities or some colleges up in around Chicago. So he was a teacher. Robert Greene was not. He was not. I didn't get the same level of experience. And he wasn't much of a talker. He kind of just settled there. He was drawing. I was drawing. There'd be hours go by where we wouldn't even say anything. So I didn't get as much out of Mr. Greene as I did of Don. But it's still interesting experience and interesting to hear his stories. You know, I kind of had to pry him for him. They were very much aligned with Don's. His experience and Don's experience were very much aligned as far as how it went at Taliesin.
Let's take a quick break to say thank you to our sponsors for their support of this episode. This episode of Entree Architect Podcast is supported by WeCollabify, one of our trusted allied partners. As this community has grown over the years, one thing has become very clear to me. The partners we choose matter. Allied partners are not sponsors. They're not advertisers. They are organizations that we've taken the time to get to know, to work alongside, and to trust. They understand the real pressures of practice and the responsibility that comes with leading a small firm. WeCollabify earned that trust by helping small firm owners address a challenge that sits at the center of long-term firm health, building capacity in a way that supports people, not just projects. Their insourcing model brings skilled design, BIM, and technical professionals directly into your team. They work in your time zone, inside your systems, and part of your day-to-day workflow. That integration allows firms to add capacity when it's needed, scale with intention, and grow without sacrificing culture, leadership focus, or quality of life. If you're thinking beyond short-term fixes and focused on building a firm that lasts, I encourage you, go learn why WeCollabify is one of our trusted allied partners. Visit WeCollabify.com/EntreeArchitect to learn more. That's WeCollabify.com/EntreeArchitect. Gain lessons learned and credits earned with Arcademy, ARCAT's continuing education program. Listen to popular episodes of the Detailed podcast and earn AIA-approved HSW credits. Yes, you heard that right, HSW credits for episodes of Detailed podcast. Listen to an episode, check out the learning objectives, and use what you've learned while listening to take the course. The program is free, it's simple, and can be found at arcat.com under the resources tab, or just go to arcat.com/arcademy. That's arcat.com/arcademy. That's arcat.com/arcademy. Please visit our sponsors today and thank them. Thank them for supporting you, the Entree Architect community. What was some of the stories they told about Taliesin?
Well, I think, you know, as far as their alignment, Taliesin kind of had two different groups of people there. You know, it's the people that were there for architecture and for Mr. Wright, and then there were Mrs. Wright's crew, and they didn't always get along. And so where Don and Robert Greene aligned is they were there for the architecture. They weren't interested in dancing or singing or anything like that that Mrs. Wright wanted them to do. And because of that, you know, there was conflict, and both of them did not like Mrs. Wright one bit. Never had one good thing to say about her. Lots of adjectives and stuff that we probably can't repeat. So that's kind of where their stories very much aligned. And that's why, you know, when Wright died in 1959, Robert Greene's like, oh, there's no way I'm staying around after this, because he knows who's taking over and what how it's going to be after that.
Was Mr. Greene in Atlanta before that? Before Taliesin, did he grow up in Atlanta?
I think he grew up in Savannah.
So nearby.
Nearby. I think it was Savannah. Don't quote me on that. I have to go back and look now, but I'm pretty sure he grew up in Savannah. I don't really remember how he landed in Atlanta, what drew him there. His body of work in Atlanta was really cool. He had an amazing website, and I actually had the, it's somewhere, I had the foresight to hire a computer guy, to ask a computer guy to save it before they removed, after he died, who's going to keep it? He had a son, and that was his only family. And so I was like, there's no way they're keeping this website up. And so, yeah, somewhere on a hard drive somewhere, I've got a copy of that website, which was, had some really cool stuff on it.
So where did you go after Mr. Wright? Did you start your own practice, or was there some steps before that?
Yeah. So down there working for Mr. Green, like I said, after 3 months, we finished the project. I went back after that and worked for Don Erickson again up in Chicago. He had some really cool stuff going on. Big Steel Cancer Centers of America. Obviously, he's got cancer and he's a very charismatic person and talk to anybody. So he made some friends at the Cancer Center of America and somehow landed a job doing a new entry, like a pavilion for that, just up north of Chicago, which is all steel and glass. So then it all kind of interlocks, super confusing. So Don Erickson wanted me to come back work for him because we had that big project. So I went back up and worked for him for another year. We had other projects too, but that was the main one. And, you know, I'm how old I am, early 20s, not really that much experience in this super complex structure. And I remember, you know, Don on the phone talking to the steel company one day, and he's like, well, how much would it cost for shop drawings of this steel? And they told him some number. He's like, we'll just do that. Well, Ryan will do the shop drawings. So, like, I had to, this is before 3D, there was 3D modeling that was out there, but nothing.
Yeah.
And so I had to build, like, cardboard cutouts just to try and figure out how this steel, because it's all on different angles and intersecting at different angles. It was crazy. But we did it. So, you know, that was the big thing. I think once we've kind of finished that, wife was graduating and we were ready to move on. And Don was really cool with that. And then, you know, through the whole process of Frank Lloyd Wright and researching that, I would go into like a Barnes & Noble. And when I was visiting my wife, we'd go into Barnes & Noble and there was looking through the architecture section. There was a book called Architects House Themselves. And I would flip through it and I found this one house that was just super weird. Looked like a spaceship. And just thought it was interesting. But then what happened is every time I'd go back, I'd find myself looking specifically for that book, flipping it to that specific page and just sitting there and staring at this house again. And because it was so weird, different, and unique, it resonated with me because I think it carried on the same principles of organic architecture that I've been studying and, you know, attracted to. Turns out that house was by an architect named Bart Prince that was out in Albuquerque. And so became fascinated with him. And, you know, through that, learned that he had worked for a guy named Bruce Goss and kind of went backtracked and looked at Bruce Goss' work. And it's like, man, how come, you know, why don't we talk about this? Or how am I just now learning about this?
Very, very unique. And when you talk about organic, it's about as organic as you get.
Yeah. It's like two parallel. They're organic architecture. Frank Lloyd Wright is very structured. And then Bruce Goff is very free. So it's two different paths down the same road. I don't even know how to, you know, it's weird.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so I was able to back into that and just got fascinated with Goff, fascinated with Bart Prince, showed it to Don. Don Erickson, the same excitement. He loved it. Was just very fascinated with it as well. Very energized by it too. The Frank Lloyd Wright, Taliesin apprentices would move from Taliesin West up to Wisconsin, you know, twice a year. They'd go down and then come back.
Right. They'd follow the weather.
Yes. And so when they would do that, they would always, groups of them would stop in Oklahoma and visit Bruce Goff, because Bruce Goff and Frank Lloyd Wright were friends. And so Don and I think Robert Green, I think, did it once, but I think they knew Bruce Goff, and because they would stop and talk to him. Bruce Goff loved that. So you know, when all the Taliesin apprentices drove through, yeah, Don was very excited about, he knew of Bruce Goff, but was very excited about that and very excited to see Bart's work. And so with Don, Don grew up in Illinois, and his dad was a stair builder. And so his dad is the one that said, hey, you should go check out architecture. Don actually was a piano player. He practiced piano like 8 hours a day up until high school. And that's what he was a piano player. That's what he was going to do. But his dad's like, you should go be an architect because his dad was a stair builder. So Don went to architecture school, University of Chicago, I think, but wasn't really excited about what he was learning in architecture school. Didn't think he was getting taught much, and had a professor that at one point, because he's like, he drew something, the professor said, nah, it's not how you're supposed to do it. And he's like, well, Frank Lloyd Wright would have done it. And the professor's like, well, you like him so much, go to him. And so that's what Don's like, all right, that's a good idea. So him and his dad just went up to Taliesin one day, got the tour, visited him, said he wants to be an apprentice there. They're like, that's great. You can sign up, but there's about 2 years of a wait. So he was very disappointed about that. But as he was traveling back, he's like, he didn't want to take no for an answer. So he picked up the phone, called Taliesin, and somebody answered. It's like, hello. And Don's like, is this Mr. Wright? He's like, yep, it sure is. He's like, all right, I want to come work for you. He's like, well, where you at? And he's like, I'm in Spring Green. I can be there in 10 minutes. And so Wright's like, come on. And so he actually got to go back because he was hard-headed and picked up the phone and didn't take no for an answer. He got to go back and actually got a tour, talk to Mr. Wright, get a tour from Mr. Wright. I think, you know, his dad was with him. And I think Mr. Wright was critiquing his dad's jacket. So I think what he told me is that Mr. Wright went and grabbed his scissors and redesigned his jacket on the spot. Like, I think he didn't like the buttons or something, so he cut the buttons off of his dad's jacket, but it said it looked better. But yeah, and then Mr. Wright's like, yeah, you can come with us down to Arizona. And so they, you know, that was his, he got to go. And so kind of that mentality with me, when I was up in Chicago working for Don, like I said, we finished that cancer center and the projects were starting to get a little thin. And it's like, I want to go work for Bart Prince. Like, I feel like out of all the people that are working now, he's kind of embodying that the most, the best. I mean, he's amazing. I want to go work for him. So I had contacted Mr. Prince off and on for a few years. And every time he's like, man, I got a list of apprentices that want to come work for me. It's like, am I on that list? So, yeah, well, what number am I? You know, where am I on that list? And so after working for Don, I just kind of said, well, I'm moving to Albuquerque. My wife and I are going to pack up all our stuff, move to Albuquerque, and I'm going to just come to your office and work for you. And he's just like, ah, all right. I was like, you don't have to pay me. You don't have to do this. I'm just going to show up. And so how can you say no to that? So that's exactly what we did. We didn't have a place to live. Neither of us had jobs. We just packed everything up in a U-Haul, went and found some like weekly Stay America kind of thing and lived there. And I went to work for Bart. Yeah. And that's probably the last part of my apprenticeship career is working for him, which I was there for about five.
How long were you there?
About 5 years, 4 or 5 years. Very similar to what happened with Don is I showed up. I'm like, I'll be here for the summer. You tired of me? I'll leave in 3 months. And went and started working there. He had a draftsman in the office. He worked out of his house as well. He had a draftsman named Jason in his office. And then it was me. I started out by just building models. He still builds cardboard models, which is fascinating and fun. And Dwell Magazine did a special on him. I think it's a video. I think if you look it up, I think it's called The Model Architect by Dwell. You just look up that. There's a short 5-6 minute video of all of Bart's models. And I'd say 80% of them, 60% of them I'd built, which was really cool.
Yeah, that's cool.
He's just like, I got this project. You can build the model. And so we started building the model that summer. And like Don, super stressful environment to work in because they're really difficult problems to solve when you're trying to build things like that. So walked in one day and you know, Jason was packing up his stuff. So Jason left and that just left me there in the office. Just me, kind of like with Don. So after 3 months, there was nowhere for me to go. I couldn't just leave Bart. So 3 months ended up being 4 or 5 years.
Then what happened after that?
Yeah, I loved it and hated to leave. But after that long, we were starting to grow roots in Albuquerque and I knew that's not where I wanted to be. So most of my family's still in Indiana and I'm, you know, it's about time to start a family our own. So I just kind of picked a city that was close to Southern Indiana, and Nashville happened to be it. Calculated decision. I looked and there's nobody doing really what I was wanting to do in Nashville at the time. And so I thought, well, it's be a good place to start and at least try. And so that's after 4 or 5 years in Albuquerque that we just kind of picked up and came here. And that was when it was just 2006. So everything's on the downhill slide. Nothing new's getting built. Nobody's hiring. So
heading to a recession.
Heading into a big recession. So I just took my tests, became a licensed architect. And then once we started coming out of recession, it was a good time, I guess, because as long as I had enough to keep me through the recession, I was able to, on the backside of it, I was able to just kind of grow with the city. And
yeah,
it grew. And we've been wide open, running wide open ever since.
And your work's primarily residential?
It is. Yeah. I mean, I'll do anything, but residential's the primary focus.
And is your work inspired by the work that you've done through your career?
Yeah, which is interesting about that is, you get projects that are different levels of creative. So you get some really cool stuff. And then with Wright, you can tell it's Frank Lloyd Wright, like everything. And so I kind of started drawing inspiration from a lot of different people. So I don't think anybody looks at my work and says, well, that's a Frank Lloyd Wright thing. But, I hope that what I do is kind of inspired by that, and use of materials, use of forms, geometry and stuff like that kind of follows the same theories. But my hope is that it comes into something that's not derivative, but something new.
So what's the future of your firm look like? Where do you want to go in the next 3-5 years? What do you want to be doing?
Yeah, I mean, like I said, Nashville's been just exploding, and I've had the opportunity to grow for a long time and have just resisted that. Like, I run pretty much a virtual office. It's just me here in the office. And then I have people that work, architects that work for me doing drafting and different things that have been with me for a long time doing an amazing job. I mean, they're the backbone of what I do. So, I feel good and comfortable with where I'm at. So I try to resist growing just because I don't want to manage people. I listen to your show. You have a lot of how to grow and how to expand and stuff like that. And I think I've had the opportunity to do that and have passed on that enough that I don't really see ever going back and doing that again. So I think I'm good with where I'm at. And you always want those more creative projects. And so I think if I could do less projects, but more creative ones, that's the goal.
Yeah, for sure. Well, you've built a brand around it. And if you go to your website, you can see that that's what you're pursuing. So hopefully that's what you'll have for yourself.
Yeah, that's all we do is, we use modern architecture. If somebody wants something traditional, or we kind of stick to the one specific type of project, really. So if somebody wants something traditional, I've got friends and people that I know that do a really good job at that. I would do an awful. If you asked me to do a house that, is like this or like that, I would just do an awful job at it. And so I was like, you don't want me doing that. Let me find you somebody that's really good at what they do and pass you on to them. So that's kind of how I just kind of stick with what I'm good at.
Well, very good. As we wrap up here, I'd love to, as a business owner, ask you my final question that I ask all my guests. What would you say is one thing that a small firm architect could do today to build a better business for tomorrow?
Yeah, and I think, sticking along the lines of there's not just one path to becoming an architect. Like most of the people that I graduated with, went on to an office, got an office job with a salary and benefits and insurance and stuff. That's not the path that I chose. None of the places that I ever worked had I ever gotten insurance or retirement account or anything like that. So, I think could say that follow your own path and stick with that, follow your dreams, but I almost might go back to the kind of Taliesin learn by doing experience. Like I think one thing that was interesting with working out in Albuquerque with Bart is that he also had a construction company. So a lot of stuff that he designed, especially there in Albuquerque, they built. And so I got a lot of actual hands-on experience building stuff. And at Ball State in Indiana, we had a design build studio semester. And so throughout my career, I've had opportunities to build stuff and work and stuff, Habitat for Humanity, stuff like that. And so, you know, I think that would probably be my piece of advice is get out, get your hands dirty, boots on the ground, build some stuff, figure out those lines that you're drawing mean something. They're there for a reason. You know, until you're out there trying to lay out a wall or trying to lay out a foundation, you know, you don't understand really what you're drawing until you have to read your own plans and figure that out. And so that would be my advice is to learn by doing, build something. You know, I think it changes your perspective and perception of what you're drawing and helps you become a better architect.
His name is Ryan Tavis. It's spelled T-H-E-W-E-S. If you are a member of the Entree Architect community, you've probably bumped into him. He's very active in our community. He's been around for a long time in the Entree Architect community. I appreciate you, Ryan, for sharing your knowledge on a regular basis with our community. So,
thank you. Appreciate what you do, Mark. It's amazing.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you. His firm is Ryan Tavis Architect. And RyanTavis.com is his website. You should go check out his website. He's got a lot of beautiful work there. Before we wrap up, if you liked today's conversation, if it inspired you and you liked what we were talking about and you want to experience Frank Lloyd Wright's legacy firsthand, I want to personally invite you to join us for the Taliesin Experience. That's our live event scheduled for June 8th. That's Frank Lloyd Wright's birthday, by the way, June 8th, 2026.
Bruce Goff's birthday, too.
There you go. We'll celebrate Bruce and Frank at Taliesin Experience. It's a rare opportunity to step into the world of Frank Lloyd Wright, to walk the grounds, experience the architecture, connect with our community of architects who are committed to building a better world and a better business and better practices and live better lives. And so, if you want to learn more about the Taliesin Experience, go visit entrearchitect.com/Taliesin, and we'd love to have you join us. Ryan, thank you for all you do. Thank you for sharing your knowledge on a regular basis throughout the community. And thanks for reaching out to me for our Nashville conference, because that was such a great experience.
Yeah.
Visiting that home that you connected us with. And thank you for coming by here and talking about your story. It's a very fascinating, inspiring story, and I hope that listeners are inspired by it. So I appreciate you for coming by here and sharing your story at Entree Architect Podcast.
I appreciate the opportunity, Mark. Thank you very much.
If you enjoyed this episode of Entree Architect Podcast, please share a link with a friend, because that's how we've continued to grow and serve thousands more small firm architects just like you. Thank you to our sponsors for this episode. Links to the sponsors and all the resources we discussed today, they are all available in the show notes for this episode at entrearchitect.com/podcast. Entree Architect is a proud member of the Gable Media Network. It's the multimedia network moving the architecture, engineering, and construction industries forward through the power of storytelling. You can earn AIA continuing education credits by listening to select episodes of this podcast and many others at gablemedia.com/members. And if you are a small firm architect, listen up. Join us today at Entree Architect Network. It's the worldwide community for entrepreneur architects. We've been around since 2012, and our basic level is now free to join. Yes, you can join Entree Architect Network for free. And that gives you access to valuable business resources and our global community of architects. And you can upgrade anytime for live coaching, AIA-approved training, and mastermind support. So visit entrearchitect.com to learn more and to get started. My name is Mark R. LePage. Thank you for listening to the Entree Architect Podcast. Love, learn, share. Attention architects and creative minds. Get ready to supercharge your brand with Build Your Brand, the podcast that's unlocking the secrets of branding success for creatives. Hey there, it's Mark R. LePage, founder of Entree Architect, and I'm inviting you to join my friend, architect marketing expert, Jeff Eccles at Build Your Brand podcast, where he explores the captivating stories of the world's top brands and transforms their lessons into powerful moves for small firm architects and creatives like you. In season one, Jeff shares the thrilling tale of Southwest Airlines, where he dissects their journey to the summit and distills it into strategies tailor-made for you.
It's important to keep in mind that companies like Southwest compete in the real world, just like you, and face real-world challenges, just like you. You might be surprised at how similar those challenges are to the struggles that you grapple with on a day-to-day basis.
Don't miss out on your blueprint for success. Subscribe, tune in, and let's build your brand together.
You may have noticed that the very best brands in the world are also known for having somewhat unique corporate cultures. That's often the glue that holds everything together when they encounter those rough spots.
We don't do it because it inconveniences the passengers to whom we are primarily dedicated, the short haul, frequent flyer.
Follow the link in the show notes to subscribe to Build Your Brand today. Remember, no matter the size, the journey's the same. Your brand's journey to the top starts here.
Imagine earning continuing education credits while doing exactly what you're doing right now. Well, you can. Gable Media has revolutionized the way you earn your continuing education credits with a groundbreaking approach. Forget running around town and scouring the internet for credit-worthy courses. Fulfill your CE requirements effortlessly by listening to engaging podcasts just like the one you're listening to now. Our podcasts are designed to educate, entertain, and inspire, all in a user-friendly environment. But wait, there's more. Architects, Gable Media is also approved as an AIA Continuing Education Services provider. Upon completion, we handle everything, from reporting your hours directly to the AIA to storing your certificates in your personal Gable Media profile for your self-reporting needs. So follow the link in the show notes and start earning your credits in the most innovative and entertaining way possible with Gable Media.